It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the Great Lakes Intertribal Council just received a $4 million grant to help fight substance abuse in Native communities in Wisconsin. We'll hear about the scope of the problem and how the grant could help.
First, 11 Republican presidential contenders will go head-to-head in the second GOP primary debate tonight at the Reagan Presidential Library. It's hosted by CNN and is scheduled to begin at 7 o'clock Central.
While Donald Trump has held on to his lead since that last debate, many of the other candidates have shifted around in the polls, including former business executive Carly Fiorina, who was not on the main stage for the last debate. She will be there tonight.
Among the leading candidates at the moment, one clear thread stands out. Fiorina, Trump, and Ben Carson are all running on backgrounds as political outsiders, and we'll see how that dynamic plays out.
We'll also be watching Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who has fallen significantly in the polls since the last debate when he spoke of himself as aggressively normal. Here with us now for a special edition of This Week in Washington is a preview of the debate with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. Paul, welcome back.
Hey, good to be with you. How are you?
Well, I'm good. Now, some things have changed, as we mentioned, since the last debate. According to the latest CNN poll, every Republican has slipped in the national polls since the debate, except Ben Carson, Donald Trump, and Carly Fiorina. This means something, I think. What does it mean, Paul?
Well, it, you know, at the moment, what it means is that the people who are answering surveys and polls are expressing an interest in outsiders. They're expressing an interest in people who have not been in Washington, you might say corrupted by Washington. It is very clear that there is an enormous frustration with the progress and the process in Washington, in Congress, in the White House. I think people are responding to that. I'm dancing around your question a little bit because, you know, I honestly can't tell you what this means about when people go to vote, right? I don't know what it means when they go to vote, but I know what it means what they're feeling now, and what they're feeling now is a little bit of outrage.
Well, it's interesting that these are people running for office, and they're denying the one aspect that the office requires. It's an office of politics, and they don't want anything to do with politics as they talk about it right now. Can that possibly stay the narrative until the election?
You know, Trump has really surprised all of us because we keep asking him questions like, what would you do to solve X or solve Y? And he gives answers that are kind of, you know, magical. He says, oh, you know, if Ford is going to move their plant to Mexico, I'll just tell them, well, heck, I'll slap a tariff on your cars and then you won't. And then everybody applauds. Well, he can't do that. I mean, the president doesn't have the authority to do that. Like, nobody seems to care. Now the question is, again, when it comes time to actually vote for people, will people then peel back and say, okay, well, we need somebody who actually knows what they're going to do and what policies they're going to implement other than just bringing the best negotiators. But there's also something to be said for a real frustration with the way government has worked, the way politics has worked, and people want to be heard. And maybe Donald has given voice to them.
Do you think we'll see a lot of this kind of insider-outsider talk at the debate tonight from those outsider candidates and maybe from, say, sitting governors who say, hey, I'm not in Washington, so I'm an outsider too?
Yeah, well, there's definitely this sort of, you know, and your Governor Walker has, I think, suffered some of this over the past a couple of months that, you know, he sort of played two different lines. One is saying, you know, oh, I've, you know, fought the unions, I've been the guy who could make change. And then on the other hand, he said, oh, I'm an outsider, I got nothing to do with, you know, government and politics. You know, it's a very fine line to run when you're running on a record, but also trying to say, well, I'm the outsider. So one of the challenges for a lot of these candidates is making it clear to observers, to viewers, what is the theme in 20 words or less you want people to think of you with? Your walk-away line, what do you want them to remember about you? If it is something like Rick Perry's oops, then you're in trouble.
We're talking with USA Today's Paul Singer right now about tonight's Republican presidential debate. And Paul, obviously one big change is that Carly Fiorina has been bumped up to the big leagues tonight.
Yes, we have a woman.
We have a woman in the race, and she's sort of already started to go mano a mano with Donald Trump. But what else do you expect from tonight's debate and from Carly Fiorina in particular?
Well, she's interesting in part because she's the only female in the race on the Republican side. She has said that that also gives her an advantage in fighting back against Hillary Clinton and making comparisons to Hillary Clinton. In the last debate, she talked a lot about her contrast to Clinton, and I expect to hear a lot of that from her again. And, you know, this will be interesting because this is an opportunity for Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina to be on stage together. He was insulting to her recently, saying that that's not the face you want to see as your president. And she shot back, saying, "I'm proud of my face and every wrinkle. You know, this is the face of a 61-year-old woman, and be proud of it." I would not be surprised to see them mix it up a little bit, and frankly, I would not be surprised to see the moderators try and prod them to mix it up a little bit. They want good TV too, so I would definitely expect to see and hear more of that.
Let's give a listen to a little bit of that Carly Fiorina speech, which was subsequently turned into a Carly Fiorina campaign ad, responding to that "look at that face" comment from Donald Trump.
Ladies, look at this face. And look at all of your faces. The face of leadership. The face of leadership in our party, the party of women's suffrage. The face of leadership in your communities, in your businesses, in your places of work and worship. Ladies, note to Democrat Party. We are not a special interest group. We are the majority of the nation. This is the face of a 61-year-old woman I am proud of every year and every wrinkle.
All right, so she's coming out strong there and going after, it sounds like, Republican women, among whom Donald Trump, apparently, according to polls, has done reasonably well. Is this an in for Carly Fiorina, Paul?
You know, the funny thing about that ad, when you listen to it, is that that could have been Hillary Clinton. With the exception of the line about, you know, "Hey, Democrats," that could have been Hillary Clinton making that case, that women are leadership. And I think none of us really understand why people are so attracted to Donald Trump at this point. I mean, I think the candidates are mystified. I think the pundits are mystified. I think the press is mystified. We keep thinking, well, why are college-educated and women are flocking to Donald Trump? How is it possible? Because he keeps saying offensive things about women. But there is a magic there that I don't understand. And I don't know whether this is the strategy that wins them back. It clearly, you know, Carly Fiorina is trying to turn this little dust-up into a call to arms for Republican women to rally around her. I don't know if it works. I'm still kind of scratching my head about how come Donald hasn't cratered.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, could that be a slingshot for Fiorina to use Donald Trump to get some momentum of her own and piggyback off his fame? And maybe she emerges the victor tonight. If they are really going at each other's throats, it'll be interesting to see who comes out the victor.
And you've seen this with a lot of the candidates, particularly the lower down the tier you go, trying to get some attention for themselves by invoking the name of Donald Trump. Bobby Jindal has been doing a lot of this, you know, like trolling him on Twitter just to see if, you know, "I'm going to start using Trump in all of my press releases just so you'll write about me." I don't know it works. But it certainly works, I think, for the top tier to try and set the contrast. It's been very clear that everybody now is willing to say, "I'm not Donald Trump because I don't believe Donald Trump has the right answers, and here's why." I think, by the way, you'll see a bunch of them tonight attacking Donald Trump for not actually being a Republican. The concern for a lot of Republicans is that if you look at Donald Trump's history, a lot of his positions have been much closer to Democratic positions than Republican positions.
If everyone does gang up on Donald Trump, though, it seems like that could have a backlash. His supporters say, look, they're all ganging up on him. They're scared of his strong message. Maybe people lean that way would feel sympathy. You know, you strike him down, he comes back stronger than you can possibly imagine in this thing.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, they could turn Donald Trump into the underdog, which, of course, is a mantle he would be proud to wear.
We're talking to USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer about the second Republican primary debate tonight. It begins at 7 Central this evening.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you want to hear the candidates answer in this debate tonight? What are you going to be looking for? Whose performance are you looking forward to see, for better or worse? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about tonight's Republican debate with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. It's the second Republican presidential debate scheduled for tonight at 7 o'clock Central.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you plan to watch, what are you going to be looking for? And who is your pick for the likely victor and likely losers? Call 800-642-1234, or you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Paul, Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin, the verdict, it seemed, on the last debate was not that he did badly, it's just that he didn't stand out all that well.
Right.
He's rebooted his campaign, kind of a tough talk on unions at the national level. What does he need to do? What do you expect to see him do tonight?
Well, you know, we have been commenting over the past week or two about the slide of Scott Walker in the polls. You know, in the summer, he was very, very popular in Iowa for a brief period of time, and sort of became the flavor of the week, and has started to trend significantly downwards, and now is trailing in the polls. And, you know, part of the problem, Rob, is you got, you know, a dozen candidates standing around, and it's hard to distinguish yourself. It's hard, again, to come away with some sort of message that makes you unique, that makes you memorable, and that makes you inspiring. And that is hard to do in a crowded field. It's hard to do an event like this. I mean, the debate tonight, my understanding of the rules is they each get a minute to respond to each question. Well, that's not much. So it sort of reduces you to sound bites. I guess what you got to do is find a sound bite that is enough to make people remember you and go, oh, yeah, that guy. We like that guy. He was good. I just don't know how you do it. I mean, it's hard to strategize for these things. It's also hard to figure out because you're in a sort of multi-layered brawl with 11 different people attacking each other all at once. It's hard to know how much you can anticipate and have a strategy for.
Well, I guess one question is, how much do debates matter, or do debates matter? Can Scott Walker go into this debate, not stand out, blend into the background, maybe not do any damage, but still be okay as far as his campaign is concerned and as far as his Iowa prospects?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Scott Walker is in jeopardy of disappearing from this race. I mean, I do think that debates matter to this degree that, you know, someone's going to be voted off the island in the next couple of days. We already lost Rick Perry. And for some, particularly some of the lower tier candidates in the earlier, what we refer to as the happy hour debate, you know, there's a real danger of just a level of irrelevance from which you cannot recover. I don't think for the top tier debate participants we're there yet, unless you do something really dumb and lose. I mean, if you forget the name of your opponent, if you forget where Syria is. If you pull a Rick Perry and say, oops, I mean, those sort of things can be fatal. I don't think you win the election on a debate in the middle of September, but you can definitely scare off a lot of supporters if you are, you know, noticeably embarrassing in public.
Talking to Paul Singer with USA Today about tonight's Republican presidential debate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do debates matter in a primary like this? What does it take for a candidate to stand out in a debate? Who are you looking forward to seeing, hearing from, for better or worse? Call now at 800-642-1234. Paul, we had an email from Jeremy who says, I want to see Carly Fiorina and Hillary duke it out for president. I think that would be a real amazing race. What do you think the chances are? It would be unprecedented to have one major party candidate be a woman, much less both.
It would be stunning. I would not rule it out. I mean, I don't know who's going to be the Republican nominee. I don't know who's going to be the Democratic nominee, for that matter. I think, you know, Hillary is clearly the favorite in the Democratic field. In the Republican field, it's a little bit of a toss-up at this point. But it would be phenomenally interesting to see two women, you know, running for the highest office in the land. We did have and you know, I don't remember my numbers because I'm not very good at math, but I remember in 2014 there were a half dozen, I believe, Senate races that were woman versus woman, and we noted that was really interesting. It just sort of speaks to the fact that women have become much more active in American politics, and that's, I think it's probably a good thing.
And going back to Ben Carson for a moment, has he been getting the short end of the stick on this? Because he's been a solid number two. He hasn't been brassy and vocal as Donald Trump has, and yet he's still been a kind of a solid number two. Why isn't he getting more attention?
Well, he's about to. That's the interesting thing about this is you remember in the first debate at one point Carson said, you know, am I going to get any time to talk here? You got any questions for me? Anybody remember me over here? But his campaign has been quite strong since then. People are responding well to his message. He's really energized some of the evangelical voters in Iowa, which is a good group to get because they're very important in the caucuses. And now he's rising in the national polls, and he's second. So now there's going to be a lot more talk about him, a lot more questions posed to him, and now he gets his moment to really star in one of these debates. Let's see how he handles it. If he handles it well, I think it's a great way for him to cement his position as a top-tier candidate. If he handles it poorly, maybe he starts to sink back to the pack.
Let's talk about issues that might come up in this debate. Immigration was a biggie last time around, driven in large part by Donald Trump talking about it leading up to it. What are you maybe expecting to see or hoping to see the candidates have to address in tonight's debate?
Well, I would not at all be surprised to see them comment on the Planned Parenthood videos that have been very inspiring, I would say, amongst the Republican base. I mean, there's been an awful lot of conversation, an awful lot of energy. And remember, this is a Republican primary, right? So the issues that tend to stand out in most of the conversations I've had recently with Republicans are the Planned Parenthood stuff is a serious concern. The Syrian refugees crisis is a big concern. There's obviously some issues about, you know, whether or not we're going to have a government shutdown. You know, those are the kind of policy issues I would expect to see some discussion about. I can't imagine they get around this conversation without talking about Donald Trump's wall along the Mexican border. You know, stuff like that. I also have to assume there will be some conversation about tax policy. You know, both Rand Paul this morning was shooting at the tax code once again. He's put out a fairly dramatic tax plan for essentially a flat tax. Jeb Bush has his tax plan out, which is sort of more traditional tax cuts. I would assume, again, in a Republican debate, tax cuts would be an issue that you'd have a lot of conversation about if they can make time for it between the, you know, slugfest.
We're going to take a caller now. We've got Dennis on the line in Appleton. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. One question I would like to see asked tonight would be, would they support term limits for Congress? Because until there's term limits there, I don't think anything's going to change.
Hey, Dennis, thanks for that. Any chance that's going to show up, Paul?
Nope. Term limits is one of those things that comes up regularly at the grassroots, pretty regularly in the states, and just cannot really be done at the federal level. It doesn't work. There's a whole bunch of reasons why, and even the candidates who promise to term limit themselves, that is, I'll run and I'll only stay for three terms, generally back out of it at some point. The fourth term comes around, they say, you know what, I'm actually pretty good at this job and I like it. The term limits they've never figured out a way to do it, in part because the Constitution, you'd have to basically amend the Constitution to do it, and I just don't see it happening.
Paul, we've talked about the outsider candidates, Trump, Fiorina, Carson. We've talked a little bit about Governor Walker. Who else has the most to gain or lose tonight in the debate?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think Jeb Bush has a lot to gain. You know, I think he has to make it look like he's a front runner again. He has been, you know, bouncing around in the polls, you know, in second or third place, not falling off the list, but he also has not asserted himself as the Republican front runner, which at one point we anticipated he would be. He certainly has the establishment behind him, and he certainly has the money. So you would expect to see him try to assert himself as the front runner. I think he has a lot to gain. Similarly, I think someone like Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, they need to be able to prove that they're serious, that they're in it for the long haul, and that they can win. And thus far, you know, they've done okay, but they're still just okay, and they have to be careful that they don't just fade out.
And Paul, before we let you go, tonight's debate is going to clock in at something like 3 hours. We were talking this morning about how there's only a 4-minute bathroom break scheduled for the candidates within that 3 hours. But given that length and the month of September, people are busy. Are people going to watch this thing tonight?
No. Well, let me rephrase that. They're not going to watch all of it. Somebody was showing me some data a couple of days ago that the viewership, even for the last debate, which had a huge viewership, starts to drop off dramatically after the first 20 minutes. So if something interesting is going to happen, it better happen early, because by the second hour, I'm watching and maybe you're watching, but I'm not sure everybody else is.
Well, Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great talking to you.
That was USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer talking about the second GOP primary debate. It's being held tonight at 7 o'clock at the Reagan National Library, and it's going to air on CNN.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The federal government just awarded a $4 million grant to help fight substance abuse in Native tribes in Wisconsin. The Great Lakes Intertribal Council is the award recipient and will partner with the state to address the issue.
We have three guests from the Great Lakes Intertribal Council with us now to talk about substance abuse in Native communities and how this grant could be part of the solution. Isaiah Brokenleg is an epidemiologist and program director. He's in the studio. Isaiah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Carol Wright is with us. She's director of the Positive Alternatives Coalition. Carol, hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And Jacob Melson is a behavioral health epidemiologist. Jake, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So, Isaiah, let's start with you and the historical context on substance abuse issues in the Native community. What's behind some of these problems?
Well, I think you have issues of poverty and structural violence. And a lot of people sometimes ask, well, why don't Indians just get over it? And I think what's happening is you have, or what you're seeing is historical trauma. And so you have, like, traditionally in a healthy situation, one generation who passes on what I like to think of as their cultural DNA to the next generation. So think of all the things you learned from your parents or family or grandparents. And when we have things like government policies and boarding schools and adoptions, that sort of interrupted that cultural DNA transmission and was replaced with all of these negative things, sexual and physical abuse in the boarding schools, interruption of the family system, concepts of gender, all sorts of things that it almost becomes like a cancer when each generation then consecutively brings down something else. So unless something's done to fix that, you're going to have these negative things that continue. And you can think of other examples of historical trauma throughout history, such as slavery or Holocaust or whatever.
And from your experience as both an epidemiologist and an enrolled member of the Rosebud Sioux tribe, how do you see these substance abuse problems affecting communities you've lived in and worked with?
Well, I think personally, some members of my family are alcoholics, and including my own father. Members of my family have been killed in alcohol-related vehicle crashes. There's disease, some self-medication, and it interrupts a lot of and creates a lot of problems within the community.
And Jake, let's bring you in now to get to the scope and some of the numbers here. First, what are we talking about when we say substance abuse? What kind of substances are we most worried about in these communities?
Well, when we say substance abuse, we're talking about many different types of alcohol and other drug abuse issues. Although Great Lakes Intertribal Council's our new SAMHSA grant, and SAMHSA stands for Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, our new SAMHSA Strategic Prevention Framework Partnerships for Success grant focuses primarily on underage drinking, binge drinking, and the non-medical use of pain relievers or prescription drugs. There's many other types of substances, and examples include commercial tobacco use, marijuana use, or synthetic drug use.
Now, for those problems you just mentioned, the alcohol and drug abuse, especially among younger members of Native communities, what do the numbers tell us there in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's important for listeners to realize, first, that alcohol and other drug abuse issues are prevalent in many communities across Wisconsin, including American Indian tribes. For many years, the prevalence of underage drinking and binge drinking among youth in Wisconsin has been higher than the national average. And although these rates have decreased during the past years, there's still a lot of work to be done. And in addition, for years, adults in Wisconsin have had the highest rates of current alcohol use, 64% according to the 2012 Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, and binge drinking among adults, 25% according to the 2012 BRFIS in the nation. And in the last 5 years, the state of Wisconsin and American Indian tribes have recognized that prescription drug abuse and misuse are also priority issues to address. Although going back to your question, it's really hard to say exactly what the numbers say, and it's really challenging because there's many different data quality issues with American Indian populations in regard to substance use.
We're talking about a new grant aimed at substance abuse in Native communities here in Wisconsin with members of the Great Lakes Intertribal Council. And, Carol, let's bring you in now. This federal SAMHSA grant, it's called, it's not the first time that there have been efforts targeting this issue. Talk about, if you will, how this will build on past efforts to tackle substance abuse in Native communities.
Sure. We have had two other previous grants that we are building this one off of. We had the Strategic Prevention Framework grant, which was a five-year grant from SAMHSA, and in that we worked with 10 of the 11 tribes in Wisconsin. So that was the building, the first brick in the building, you could say. Then after that, we had a one-year strategic prevention enhancement grant, and that in that particular grant, we worked on four particular areas to develop an intertribal strategic plan for prevention. We looked at data collection, analysis, and storage. We looked at training and technical assistance. We looked at collaboration and coordination of services. And we also looked at evaluation concepts. All of this was done while incorporating the use of the traditional Native American medicine wheel and the four directions. So we felt that this was taking some of SAMHSA's language and putting it into more culturally appropriate language and into a system that was circular rather than linear and that tribes could probably feel more comfortable with.
Isaiah, before we get into the details of the grant, Carol just mentioned culturally appropriate approaches. Now, whether we're talking about Native Americans or white Wisconsinites or inner city substance abuse problems, how important is trying to tailor culturally appropriate solutions to solving problems of substance abuse?
Well, I think it's of utmost importance. And I think one of the problems in public health is we're always taught to get the biggest bang for our buck or reach the biggest population. And what often that does is it actually serves to perpetuate health disparities because when you're tailoring it to meet the biggest population, that means you're tailoring messages to the majority and often to urban areas. And the culture in minority communities or and rural communities is often different. And so the messages that you're delivering and giving won't work. And sometimes actually serve to even make the situation worse.
And Carol, as Jake mentioned a few moments ago, three main areas in this grant, underage drinking, young adult binge drinking, and prescription drug misuse and abuse. Based on the work you've been doing previously on those past grants, why were those three top priorities this time around?
Well, actually, SAMHSA defined what priority areas to look at for us. And so my assumption would be that that's based on the national data and what they were seeing across the nation in terms of priorities for substance abuse prevention. So we were given that opportunity then to look at those priority areas and decide whether or not we would address one or all of those areas. And because our tribes in previous assessments have given us data that shows all of those areas were important to them, that is why we are addressing the areas we're addressing.
Let's dig into the what and how. What kind of things will be done with this grant support to target those problems?
Well, using the Strategic Prevention Framework, which includes assessing the situation, building capacity, doing planning, implementing, and then evaluating, our first year will be spent primarily doing assessments. We did an assessment in all four of the partnering tribal communities in 2011, and that's what we based our information for a grant application off of. But we will go back in again, and then with these specific substance uses, be taking a look at the assessment. And the other thing that we'll do with that assessment is identify if there are any other particular priorities in substance abuse prevention that any of the four tribes might have.
And you mentioned those four tribes, Carol, the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, Lacouture Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. Why those four in particular in this project?
Well, what happens, generally speaking, at Great Lakes is that when we see a grant that we think might meet the needs of the tribes are notified and they're asked whether or not they would be interested in participating. In this case, the four tribes did indicate that they would like to partner with us on this grant. And I think, as Jake has mentioned, the data shows that they have issues in those priority areas that the federal government has outlined for us. So that's why we are working with those particular four. In our previous SPFSIG grant, we worked with 10 of the 11 tribes in Wisconsin. So there's been some capacity built at all of the tribes, and what we will be doing is assessing and building on the capacity that the tribes need to be able to collect and store data. We will be looking at workforce development issues and bringing in certified prevention specialists who have been trained particularly in Native American approaches for prevention.
We'll get into what some of those specifically Native American approaches might be in a few moments as we talk about a new federal grant just awarded to the Great Lakes Intertribal Council to tackle substance abuse issues in Native communities here in the state. We have three guests from the organization, Isaiah Brokenleg, Carol Wright, and Jacob Melson.
And we're taking your calls on this. Do you have personal experience with substance abuse in a Native community? And what do you think would help address drug and alcohol abuse in Native American communities? Call in now, share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with three guests from the Great Lakes Intertribal Council. Isaiah Brokenleg is an epidemiologist and program director. Carol Wright is the director of the Positive Alternatives Coalition, and Jacob Melson is a behavioral health epidemiologist.
Talking about a new federal grant that the Great Lakes Intertribal Council just received to help address substance abuse issues in Native communities in Wisconsin. Carol, a few moments ago, you mentioned Native American-specific approaches, that there will be counselors trained into those. Can you give a couple examples of what those might look like?
Well, we subscribe to the thought that culture is prevention. So if cultural practices are in place and used routinely, they work as non-alcohol, non-drug type activities, and they promote the health and well-being of a tribal community. So when we look at things like this, we would be looking at, and it may differ also from tribe to tribe. We'll be working with three Ojibwe tribes and one Menominee tribe, and there may be differences. But some of the traditional types of things that we look at are sweat lodges, talking circles, things along that line, things that were grounded in Native society years ago, and things that kept those communities healthy. So we will be looking at those kinds of things, and we are also looking at finding a way to give credence to those approaches. The federal government currently looks at evidence-based practices. The cultural activities that we will be looking at are considered practice-based evidence. And what we are looking at is a way to vet some of these normal activities that occur in tribal communities to be accepted as good prevention activities.
Let's go to a caller. We've got Winona on the line in Bad River. Winona, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Winona?
Well, I just had wanted to share my own thoughts on these issues. I'm from Bad River Band of Wisconsin, and I grew up actually in Minneapolis, and I wanted, and I actually sort of developed my own substance abuse issues, but I think that it's really one reason that this is sort of happening is that there is a sort of cultural loss and language loss especially, and I think that a lot of Native youth, and the reason I started using was because I didn't really know who I was, but I think that one thing that the tribes could really be looking towards doing is programs revitalizing culture and language, because an immersion programs and summer-long cultural camps, because through those, each Native person finds that they actually have a very special place in this world.
And Winona, did you find that, dealing with your own substance abuse problems, did you find that connection with culture actually helped you deal with those issues?
Yes, because I realized that the whole reason I used was that I didn't know that there was any purpose for me in this world, but through culture and learning that I actually had my own role in this world and an Indian name and my own clan, I realized that I didn't need to use, because there is so much more important things that need to be done in this world.
Winona, thank you so much for sharing your experience. Isaiah, from what she said and what Carol was saying about working on those cultural traditions, are these ways to reconnect that chain that was lost that you were talking about earlier?
Absolutely. There's actually something called the People's Theory. It was developed by the Phillips Powderhorn Cultural Wellness Center out of the Twin Cities, and it just says that as you lose your culture, you lose your health. And then sort of the opposite of that theory is as you gain your culture, you gain your health. And I think that's a concrete example of what Winona was talking about.
Winona, thanks again for that call. We're talking to members of the Great Lakes Intertribal Council about a new grant targeting substance abuse in Wisconsin tribal groups. Jake Melson, I want to bring you back in. How are you going to be measuring success of these efforts? How are we going to know if the things you're doing are having an impact?
Well, we are going to be collecting data throughout the entire grant to determine what changes need to be made and to ensure that we're meeting the objectives of the grant. I think it's important for people to realize that there are data out there that demonstrate that culture is prevention. We talk about that a lot in our Great Lakes Intertribal Council's prevention strategic plan. It's on our website. And there's the Journal of Psychoactive Drugs, Volume 43, Issue Number 4 from the 2011, talks all about culture as prevention.
And Carol, what are your hopes here for this grant? What kind of difference are you hoping this makes?
Well, as I said, we're building on previous successes, and we want to increase capacity at the tribes to be able to have data that will help them make prevention strategy choices based on that data, and in the end then look at having some impact on usage. We will be measuring underage drinking, young adult binge drinking, and the reduction of prescription drug abuse and misuse by 5% at the end of the grant period. We're also looking at increasing the perception of harm of those particular substance abuse use issues within the communities. We know that perception has a large impact on substance use, so if you can increase the perception of harm of these particular substances, you probably also will be seeing a decrease in the usage.
And Isaiah, let's give you the last word. There is, at the risk of understatement, a complicated historical relationship between Native Americans and the U.S. government. How is news of this grant from that government being received in Native communities in Wisconsin so far?
Well, I can't speak for all American mm-hmm. Indians, but I can say that people are usually really excited when you find out about these grants. Sometimes due to legislation and funding and things, they have to end early. This is supposed to be a 5-year grant. We've recently had one that was supposed to be 5 years and ended at 3. And it, when that happens, it sort of creates all of this tension again about like trust and how do we regain that trust and how do we build that trust. And I think it's important that when the government says they're going to do something, that they continue to do it to build these relationships and maintain them.
And we started by talking about the impact substance abuse has on communities that you've seen among people, even in your family. Are you hopeful? Is this part of a hopeful step in the right direction, do you think?
Absolutely. I think we have to focus on the future, and we talk about thinking 7 generations ahead, and we want a future that is healthy, hopeful.
Well, thanks to all of you. We've been talking to Isaiah Brokenleg, Carol Wright, and Jacob Melson. They are all with the Great Lakes Intertribal Council. We're talking today about a new federal grant that was just awarded to the Great Lakes Intertribal Council aimed at tackling substance abuse issues in Native communities in Wisconsin. If this is an issue in your community, if you're part of one of these communities or work in one, we'd still love to hear from you. Send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or send us a message over at the Central Time Facebook page. According to Mark Zuckerberg himself, Facebook users are going to get something they've been looking for quite a while, a dislike button or something along those lines. And the button isn't meant to diss somebody's post, not an angry reaction, but to be able to respond to something, maybe sad, that somebody else has posted.
Zuckerberg says the dislike button is basically a tool for expressing empathy. And we've all been there, right? Someone you know posts that maybe they lost their job, maybe they're struggling with an illness, and you don't really want to click the like button in that instance, but there will soon be that dislike or some other word button.
In the world, I guess, before Facebook, if we can remember that, you'd call or send an email or a card, maybe. But now you can be able to click dislike or something like that to say, hey, I'm acknowledging this. I'm sorry about that. That could be a good thing, I think.
It's a good thing. The idea of expressing empathy at the click of a button, I'm still wrapping my head around, but I guess it's maybe better than clicking a like button.
Yeah, but dislike might not be the way to go. I've seen some people saying it might not be the word dislike, but say you put a post and it's got a sad thing on it or something, and you'll have the option of saying, okay, instead of clicking like, we're going to change that like button to I hear you, or sorry, or hugs, or support, or something like that. So it's an empathy equivalent. But they're not trying to start more angry battles on Facebook than there currently are.
Yeah, and then you'll be counting how many hugs did I get on Facebook today.
Yeah, exactly. Well, quick, like us, Central Time on Facebook, while you still can, before we put that dislike button up there for you.